All right. Yesterday, we kind of just went over the structure. For those of you that weren't here, I guess you can get the lectures online. But we just kind of went over the structure, just a really quick general outline. But what I want to do is I want to kind of start off by keeping the outline up there and asking what are some of the key themes that are going through Matthew. First of all, I'll throw that question open to you. What are some of the key themes outside of kingdom? What are some of the key themes that you see running through the Gospel of Matthew?
Old Testament.
Why would you say that? I agree with you 100%.
He quotes it more than anybody else.
He sure does. Yeah, I mean, outside of the book of Revelation, there may be no other book in the New Testament that has this much Old Testament relation. The book of Revelation is bursting at the seams with it, but this one is pretty close. I mean, we're talking at least 50-something direct citations, maybe over 262 allusions in this. And we even have, what we're going to find, is there's even something called a fulfillment formula that we'll find 11, maybe 12 times, depends on how you debate that last one, that'll happen throughout the book. And five of them occur in the first two chapters. What is that telling me? If five of the fulfillment language, which will say something like this, as it was said in the prophets, and then he quotes something. That's the fulfillment stuff I'm talking about, the fulfillment formula. If he does it five times in the first two chapters, what is he saying?
Christ is the fulfillment.
It's the fulfillment. But what's the significance of it being packed so much in the first two chapters?
The birth is really important for the entering of the kingdom.
Yeah, that the birth is really important, but also this is setting the tone for the entire book. Everything that comes after the first two chapters needs to be read in the lens of the Old Testament. Because the first two chapters are trying, they're like yelling at you. Hello? He's fulfilling something here. And it does it five times in two chapters. And then it'll do it six other times throughout the rest of the book. So right off the bat, we're getting hammered with the Old Testament. That Jesus is the fulfillment of what?
Law
and the Prophets, Old Testament, what else? The Messiah, what else?
Israel
as a nation, right? The fulfillment language in Matthew is what we will see just bursting out of the seams here. Except this, Jesus is not just fulfilling things, he is superseding them. He is not just another Israel. He is what Israel was never able to be. He is not just another Moses. He is what Moses was never able to be. Not just another Jonah. He is greater than Jonah. He is greater than David. And that is the consistent rhythm of Matthew. We're going to look at that really quick. Make sure you have your Bibles open because we're in an exegetical class. Jesus even says in Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5, verse 17, that I have not come to abolish the law, but to what? To fulfill it. But he's not just fulfilling something, he is exceeding it. As a matter of fact, Jesus is portrayed in Matthew as greater than Israel. He is the true Israel, but he is greater than Israel. Everywhere where Israel fails, we'll see in the first four chapters, Jesus succeeds. Every single point of their history where they fail, Jesus succeeds. As a matter of fact, let me ask you this question. In Matthew chapter 10, we are going to have a list of Jesus' key disciples. How many of them are there? Why is that important? Yeah. There's 12. It's not an accident that he chose 12. Because there's also 12 tribes of Israel, right? And who chose chose the 12 tribes of Israel through giving birth to them? God himself. Yeah? He created a nation made up of 12 brothers that developed into 12 tribes. Jesus is creating what? A nation made up of 12 disciples that will birth others. He doesn't choose 12 on accident. He's saying, I am Israel, but I'm greater. As a matter of fact, Jesus, in Matthew chapter 19, verse 28, after the rich young ruler situation, Peter's like, well, my goodness, then who can make it in? And Jesus looks at him and he says, don't you know that you 12 will sit on 12 thrones and you will judge the 12 tribes of Israel? Whoa. First of all, those are fighting words. In case you didn't catch that. That's not just like a cool theological thought. If a Jew heard that, they'd be like, who's judging who now? Jesus is saying, I'm not just creating another Israel. I'm creating something greater than Israel ever wanted to be. Because they fail consistently. And as we go through the history of the political Israel today, you'll see how they wonderfully fail all the time. Jesus is also, though, greater than Moses. Here is something very important about the structure. How many discourses are there? Why is that number significant? Ever heard of the word Pentateuch? What does that word mean? What's it refer to? First five books of the law. Now, traditionally, who was the person that wrote that? I'm not arguing for the authorship of these five. I'm asking who is traditionally the one seen to have written the first five books of the Old Testament?
Moses.
And what was Moses best known for? Outside of the Exodus. What did the Exodus lead to? I'll give you a hint. It was at a mountain.
Give me the law.
The law. And what does the law do? What is law? What is the purpose of law? In our society, in their society, what does law do? It keeps order, but even more importantly, it defines a nation's identity. The purpose of a law is not just to keep people in line, it's to give people an identity. And you can understand what people are trying to communicate that they are by looking at some of their laws. We won't get into that right now, but we will eventually. But Jesus gives five discourses because he is being shown through Matthew as not just a new Moses, but a Moses that is greater than Moses ever wanted to be. As a matter of fact, in Matthew chapter 28, verse 20, Jesus says that you are to obey everything that he has commanded. What has he commanded? The law. We get Jesus' Pentateuch. Why? Because he's defining a new nation. He's establishing a kingdom. You follow me? As a matter of fact, on the Mount of Transfiguration, Matthew chapter 17, Jesus and the inner three, they go up there, Peter, James, and John. And who appears on the Mount of Transfiguration? Elijah and Moses. Why are those two people significant in the Old Testament? Moses kind of was associated with what? The law. And who was Elijah associated with? Or not who, but what? What? Prophets. I guess it'd be what, Andrew? The prophets. So whenever Jesus says, I've come to fulfill the law and the prophets, it would not surprise us on the Mount of Transfiguration that the two representatives of the law and the prophets show up. Now Peter's like, hey, let's build tabernacles. Let's all stay up here. And God says, shut up, Peter. Listen to my son. And they all fall down at the voice of God. When they look up, what happens? It's just Jesus. What is that saying? Literally, what is that saying? That everything that Moses and Elijah were pointing to is fulfilled in him. God says, shut up, listen to him. They fall down, they look up, and it's only him. Because he is the fulfillment of all the law and the prophets. He's not just another Moses. He is greater than Moses ever dreamed of being. Are you tracking with me? It's not just Moses, it's also David. We'll see that in Matthew chapter 22. He's not just another David, he is greater than David. And all of this is pulling towards, all of this is building up to the establishment of what? Jesus says the Messiah, but what does the Messiah usher in? The kingdom. As a matter of fact, in Matthew chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, John the Baptist, first words of his public ministry, he says, repent, for what is near? The kingdom of heaven. Jesus, in Matthew chapter 4, verse 17, the first public words he speaks, not the first words in general, because he talks to Satan a little bit, the first words that he speaks publicly in his public ministry is what? Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near. Matthew chapter 10, verse 7, Jesus sending out his disciples to go to all the surrounding villages, and what does he tell them to say? Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near. What is Matthew trying to communicate?
Kingdom's near.
Kingdom is near! Now here's the question. If you're a Jew, and you are sitting in the audience, and you hear John, and you hear Jesus, and you hear the disciples saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near, I want to ask the question throughout the rest of the class, what would they have heard? That's an important question, isn't it? What am I establishing here? Give you a hint. Starts with a C. Context! That's an important word, is it not? Why is context important to establish?
Because they would have been thinking about the Romans.
Just talking. Oh, wait. That's all right.
They would have been thinking about him establishing a kingdom like instead of the Romans.
Maybe. Maybe it's because the Romans would have been around and that's a kingdom that's warring at the time, right? Why else? Why is it important for me to establish this context?
To understand the original intent of the letter.
Yeah. Well, it's also to understand the original intent of the letter, but it's also this. Why was Jesus crucified if he was going to give him a kingdom? We've got to, in some sense, understand the friction between Jesus and the people that are listening to him. Because if he comes around saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand, you'd think they'd be excited. Because they know it's not the same kingdom as the one that's ruling over them now. They know it's going to be a new kingdom. And he's a Jew speaking. Wouldn't that get Jews excited? Well, in the Gospels, it gets them excited enough to hang him on a tree. Why?
Because they expected an earthly king?
Because they expected, well, they expected something different than what he was given. And that's what we're going to trace today. What we need to do is we need to go back to the very first really political situations of Israel in the Old Testament. That's right. We're going to hang out in the Old Testament pretty much all day today, but we're going to move from the Old Testament before the monarchy was established. Everyone understands the word monarchy, correct? It means basically just a kingdom. So if I use that word, just associate with kingdom. Before the Israeli monarchy is established, all the way up to the year 135 AD, we're going to span, you know, just a couple thousand years in hopefully 25 minutes or so. 35 minutes. Can't add. Doesn't matter. I'm 5 loaves, 2 fish. Okay. So pre-Jewish monarchy, the political situation that was set up after the Exodus. They come out of the Red Sea. They get away from the bondage of Egypt. And they go to the Promised Land. Now it's not Moses. It's Joshua. They're in the Promised Land. How were they politically functioning when they were in the Promised Land? How would God lead his people during that time? What would he do? What?
Judges.
Exactly. And what would happen with the judges? What would they do? Were they the ones that ruled over the people at all times?
No, they were liberators.
Yeah, they were occasional liberators. They, whenever an occasion arise, whenever God needed somebody to do his bidding, the Holy Spirit would come down on them and they would function as his agent. And then once the task was done, they were done. Right? It was a pure theocracy where God was the sole king and the people moved according to his bidding. This is the second form of Israel's political system. Are you following me? Who is the primary king in this situation?
God.
That's going to be really important for what happens in a minute. I will say this though, during this time period, there's really not much Messiah language in the Old Testament. In this time period, in the Judges period. I don't even know if we have any Messianic texts in the Judges. We don't really have much kingdom talk. As a matter of fact, we do have some kingdom talk at the end of Judges. But it almost kind of is lamenting the fact that during that time they didn't have a kingdom, which is interesting. But we don't have a lot of robust language there. And the reason why is because they weren't looking for a future political system because the one that they had at the time was the one God wanted. Kind of. Because there's two rebellions by the nation of Israel. The first one happened when? Don't think nation, think two people.
Cain and Abel.
At the fall. Cain and Abel is a bad one too. No, that just perpetuates what happened for their parents. Because the very first rebellion happens in the pristine political situation in the Garden of Eden, right? Because what was the temptation? What was the temptation that they succumbed to? What was it? To be like God. The one that is totally in control. The one that is absolutely sovereign. You can be like, all I gotta do is eat this fruit. That's all you gotta do. And they rebel. And do you know where the very first messianic text is in the entire Bible? Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. It's a retrospective text in the sense that we look back and say, oh, clearly that is talking about the Messiah. Because it talks about the serpent striking his heel, but he will crush its head. Notice when the first one comes at the very first rebellion. The messianic language, the kingdom language, explodes in the Old Testament at the second rebellion. Turn to me with me to 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Samuel is the prophet that's going to be kind of bridging the pre-monarchy and the monarchy period. But notice how this comes about. I'm going to read this whole chapter, so hopefully you're there with me. Because this is very important to see how God views the monarchy. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. And the judges were not people that would be lording it over the kingdom, but they would be the ones that God would come upon whenever something was needed. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us." At this point, it sounds like they're doing something noble, doesn't it? I mean, his sons are a mess. Samuel's about to die. They're thinking, if these idiots are the ones that are left in charge of us, we're going downhill quick. So they're like, "Well, why don't you just appoint a king? And that'll help us out." You're thinking, wow, good elders. Job well done, shepherds of the people. But notice, listen to the explanation of why they want it. They say, "Now appoint us a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." What are they saying? We don't like the system God's put into place. We want what they have. But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. Good thing to do. And the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king." Did you just hear that? When they ask for a monarchy, when they ask for King Saul, when they ask for King David, what is it that they're actually doing, according to 1 Samuel 8? Rejecting God as their king. Whoa, that's weird. I thought it was a good thing. Well, let's keep reading. "As they have done from the day I brought them out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now, listen to them. But warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do." Now listen to how he describes what the king is going to do to the people. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands, others commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest. There's still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day." What is he turning them into, the king? What is that a description of?
Egypt?
Every other stinking empire that has ever reigned. Right? What was Rome? What did Rome do? That kind of sounds like Rome. What did Babylon do? It kind of sounds like Babylon, Persia, Greece. It doesn't matter. That's what empires do. They rape the land, they destroy the people, and they keep the best for the rich while keeping the rest of the nation that's in bondage, in oppression, poor. Right? But the people refused to listen to Samuel. "No," they said, "we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles." Who was fighting their battles before this? God. When Samuel heard all the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered, "Listen to them and give them a king." See, the words there, "give them a king," doesn't sound like God saying, "Good idea, let's give them a king." He's saying, "Fine, you want a king? You can have it. I'll give it to you. I'll give you what you want. I don't want you to be in a situation that you don't like. I'll give you what you want, but trust me, you're not going to like it." It is at this point that the messianic and kingdom language begins to explode in the Old Testament. It doesn't explode to the mass amount we're going to get in a minute. But you have one of the very first texts, whenever David is installed as king, 2 Samuel chapter 7, 11 through 17. One of the most important things relating to the kingdom of Israel and to the Messiah says this: I will establish the throne of his kingdom, which would be David, his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be my son. Your throne shall be established forever. Then, if you think about it, all of the Psalms, you know, like Psalm 2 and Psalm 110, all those Psalms that we look back and they're messianic Psalms? When they were first written, they weren't messianic Psalms. When they were first written, who were the Psalms talking about? Yeah, the King of Israel. The Ascension Psalm is the ascension of the King of Israel to his throne. It uses God-like language, but its focus primarily, initially, was not to the Messiah. It was to the King of Israel. This language starts to develop, but the language really explodes during the time of the exile. We have more kingdom language, more messianic talk in the exile than in any other place in the entire Old Testament. And here's my question. Why? What?
They needed hope.
They needed hope, right? When you're in times of oppression, and many of you probably never experienced this, but when you're in times of absolute oppression, where you're literally scraping for food because the rich man won't let you have it, you start longing for that which you don't have. And what was taken away from Israel whenever Assyria in 722 takes the northern kingdom away, or Babylon in 605 and 586 takes away the southern kingdom? What were they lacking? What?
Temple worship.
Temple? What else? The temple was destroyed by the Babylonians, remember. Something that would happen again later. What else are you missing?
Dignity?
Because man, even your kings are walking in shackles into another people's territory. That doesn't give you much honor. What else are you missing?
Home.
What?
Home.
Home! You don't even have a land anymore. Nothing is familiar around you. What God gave you through Moses and Joshua is no longer yours. You've lost the very promised land of God. What else? Identity. You have no identity. You have absolutely no identity. You are not a nation. You're an exile. You're a slave. I'm not going to apply this yet to modern day stuff. But a deep longing begins to occur inside the people that are in exile. And it's during this time where the messianic language explodes in the Old Testament, where kingdom language explodes, because they're longing for an identity, they're longing for their kingdom to be restored. Why? Because they're in exile, and they need another exodus. But what would this include? If you're a Jew and you're longing for the kingdom, and matter of fact, we're going to be tracing now, we're going to go all the way up to the first century. But what develops during this time period of exile, all the way up even to the time of Jesus, is really four key elements that they were desiring to happen for their kingdom to be once again established. The first element is that they would be returned from exile. They would come home. And this really would have three implications. You'd have a land implication, that they would be back to the promised land. You would have a cultic implication, which would mean that the temple would be reestablished, that the high priest would be put back in his position. Why is the high priest really important for them as an identity, as a nation? What is the high priest's function? He is the mediator between the nation and God. So they want to return from exile to get their promised land back, to have the high priest established, but not just any person that raises their hand. They want it from the Zadokite lineage. Right? It's the high priest. He can't just be from any family. Then they also would also want the political situation rearranged, which would mean they're not under foreign domination. Which leads us to the second one. The only way for this to occur is for them to defeat the evil. And oh my goodness, we're going to read some stuff here in a minute. They don't want to just defeat the evil. They don't want to just, you know, push them off the land and get what they want. They want to destroy them. They want to, you know, kind of things like bash their babies against the rocks type of stuff. Does that sound familiar? I think that's a Davidic song, if I remember right. They also want this to ultimately lead to the reign of Yahweh himself at Zion. See, the point of coming back from exile and defeating the evil is so that God himself will reign, because whenever Babylon takes Israel into its nation, into it totally destroys the nation of Israel, destroys the temple, basically what you could say is that the god Marduk of Babylon is stronger than Yahweh. Do you have any evidence to prove otherwise? You're in chains. They want Yahweh to be put back in his position of exaltation. But really what they want is the fourth element. They want their nation to be exalted. They want to be in a position of dominance. They want to be the ones that are calling the shots. They want to be the rulers, whether it be foreign or native. They want to be the ones in power. The nation of Israel will be exalted in the golden age. All of this is the Jewish kingdom, the key elements. This is the golden age that the Jews wanted. And what is this? This is a return back to 1 Samuel 8. You see that? What they want is to go back to what they thought they had in 1 Samuel 8. But what was it that God said they had in 1 Samuel 8? Rejection of him. Here's my question. Why do we think that when Jesus came, he was going to reestablish this? Let me just even get a little eschatological on you here. Why do we think when Jesus comes again, there's going to be 1,000 years where this reigns again? Huh. Isn't that weird? Because this is a description of what? Rebellion against God. 1 Samuel 8. If Jesus came and just reestablished this, he would be perpetuating the rebellion that had been lasting for thousands of years. He's not going to reestablish this. He's going to give something greater than this. Nevertheless, the Jews longed for this golden age, and so what they did is they took their Messiah figure, and they trained. There's two key strands that the Messiah had to have in order to accomplish this. Number one, he had to be Davidic. He had to be from the line of David, or he was not the true Messiah. Lineage is a big deal for them. We'll find that out, especially tomorrow. He had to be Davidic. And you see this, and we're actually going to trace this through three different groups. Because really, leading up from the time of exile in 586 all the way up to the first century, three different Jewish groups emerge. One of them is the Old Testament. You can see this in the Old Testament. The warrior king in Psalm chapter 110, verse 1 through 5. I'll just read it. You know, you can turn there, but I'll be done reading by the time you get there. Is Psalm 10 an important 110 an important passage in the New Testament? Do you know the interesting fact about Psalm 110 in the New Testament? Hebrews. It is the most referred to psalm in the entire Bible. Now listen to this. Listen to this doozy. The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. The Lord will extend your mighty scepter from Zion. You will rule in the midst of your enemies. Who's on focus here? Who's the focus on? The enemies getting theirs. Oh, it gets better. Your troops will be willing on your day of battle. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Hebrews. The Lord is at your right hand. He will crush kings on the day of his wrath. He will judge the nations, heaping up the dead and crushing the rulers of the whole earth. He will drink from a brook beside the way. Therefore, he will lift up his head. Key messianic psalm. What's it all about? The enemy getting theirs. The Messiah king in the Jewish tradition had to be Davidic and a warrior. He had to be Davidic and a warrior. But that's not just found here. It's even found in Judaism outside of the Old Testament. Psalms of Solomon 17. Psalms of Solomon. It is not Song of Solomon. This is a what's called a pseudepigraphical text. What does that mean? It's in the pseudepigraphy. What is pseudepigraphical work or pseudepigraphy mean? What's that? What's that? Yes. It's somebody claiming to be Solomon, but he's not. So he's using a pseudonym or a false name, pseudepigraphical. This is actually probably written around 50 BC during the establishment of Rome over Israel. And it's probably written by Pharisees. Is that going to be important for when we're studying Matthew? Please tell me yes. Thank you. It will be, because we'll see the Pharisees all the time. But listen to what this says. Psalms of Solomon 17, 21 through 26 and 32. It says this. See, Lord, and raise up for them their king, the son of David, to rule over your servant Israel, the time known to you, O God. Undergird him with the strength to destroy the unrighteous rulers, to purge Jerusalem from Gentiles who trample her to destruction. In wisdom and in righteousness, to drive out the sinners from the inheritance, to smash the arrogance of sinners like a potter's jar, to shatter all their substance with an iron rod, to destroy the unlawful nations with the word of his mouth. At his warning, the nations will flee from his presence. And he will condemn sinners by the thoughts of their hearts. He will gather a holy people, whom he will lead in righteousness, because there will be no unrighteousness among them in his days. For all shall be holy, and their king shall be the Lord Messiah. And there's a thirst for blood there that I don't know if you've ever felt. And there's a longing for the evil to get theirs. And whose job is it to do it? Messiah's, according to Judaism outside the Old Testament. Also, Qumran, same thing. 11 QM, 11, 8 through 9 says this. By the hand of your anointed one, seers of things appointed, you have told us about the times of the wars of your hands in order that you may fight, that you may glorify yourself among our enemies. Who is he talking to? The Messiah. So in Judaism, what did the Messiah need to be? Two things. This is a good test question, by the way. Two things. What is it? It doesn't matter if you're talking Qumran, outside the Old Testament, or the Old Testament itself. Two things. What did it need to be? Divinic and what?
Warrior.
And through that two-pronged description, the Messiah would gather the dispersed tribes of Israel, return them from exile, conquer the wicked enemies, judge, be a warrior, and basically establish the First Samuelite kingdom. This is what they're thinking when Jesus is talking in the first century. This is what all their literature is pointing them to. This is how they're interpreting everything from the Old Testament to Qumran. That there will be a day when the Messiah comes and the kingdom is established, and guess what's going to happen? Oh, it doesn't matter who's in charge. They're going down, and it's going to be beautiful. Yep. Yeah.
So, I kind of want to know if this is too strong to like assume or say, but do you think that they saw it more as a lust for justice than anything?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it was. And this is what usually happens whenever you're talking with oppressed people in any situation. Usually whenever the oppressed come to positions of power, what do they end up becoming? Oppressors. It's a perpetual cycle. And the Jews were no different. They wanted justice, but justice wasn't good enough for them to be free. They wanted them to be punished for what they had done. This is why, if you notice, in the Songs of Solomon, instead of whenever the Messiah starts to reign, instead of the nations flocking to him, what are they doing? They flee from his presence. They don't want to become what God wanted them to be, a light to the Gentiles. They want the Gentiles to die. Why? Because the Gentiles are the ones that are ruling over them. Oh no, it's a deep lust for justice. It's a bloodthirst. Most bloodthirst is revenge, and justice is a very fine line. Which is something... which is something... okay, so leading up to, let's talk history now. Leading up to the first century, the Jews got the messianic figure that they were wanting through a family known as the Maccabees. First Maccabees and Second Maccabees will describe the stuff I'm talking about here, okay? At this time, 175 BC, the Greek Empire is reigning. And there's a man in power known as Antiochus Epiphanes. Not a good guy. Okay? 175 BC, Jason, who is the brother of the high priest was a Zadokite, that's important. Jason decides to set a new precedent. He goes to Antiochus Epiphanes, offers him a bribe to establish him as the high priest over all of Israel. And that's what happens. Jason comes to power, and as soon as he gets into power, what he starts doing is he starts implementing this particular agenda. And the agenda is to Hellenize all of Israel, to make them Greek, to turn them into another part of the Greek nation, or the Greek empire. And that's what happens. First thing he does, he builds a gymnasium in Jerusalem. Gymnasiums were where, you know, the Greeks did all their games. And the reason why this was so bad was because the priests liked the idea of the games so much that the priests stopped doing their sanctuary duties. And they start going down and wrestling in the gymnasium. Now, there's something else you need to know about the wrestling.
Yeah.
They wrestle naked! Which, if you're a Jew that's been circumcised, becomes a problem. Because you don't look like the other guys. And so literally what was happening in Jerusalem was priests were doing and getting surgeries to become uncircumcised. If you become uncircumcised, what are you saying? What does circumcision stand for? Jewish identity, the covenant with God. They're saying, we don't even care about the covenant. We want to be like the other nations. Well, the precedent that Jason started ended up backfiring on him because Menelaus, who wasn't a part of the Zadokite lineage, decides, I'll outbid Jason to become high priest. So he goes to Antiochus, offers an even higher amount, and Antiochus says, yeah, that's good, you do it. So Menelaus goes to power. The problem is that this bribe was a monthly bribe. So what did he have to do in order to pay it? He had to increase all the taxes even more on the peasants in order to pay for his power. But that wasn't enough. So Menelaus not only had to raise the taxes, he also had to start plundering the temple treasury in order for him to pay for this exorbitant bribe. Now, if you start raising taxes on peasants, you're going to get a little bit people upset, maybe some revolts. You start plundering the temple treasury, violence will occur. And that's what happened. Violence starts going crazy. People are just, they're freaking out. Antiochus comes and he starts just punishing them brutally to the point where in 1 Maccabees it describes women that were caught circumcising their children were hung and their children were hung around their necks. I mean, it got a little crazy. So Antiochus eventually starts to put it down. He ends up issuing a decree that basically mandates a desecration of the sacrifices that were occurring in the temple. At this time, there was a man by the name of Mattathias. Mattathias was a priest. Not a part of the Zadokite lineage, but he wasn't the high priest, he was just a priest. He is instructed to give one of these sacrilegious sacrifices. He goes forward and he says, I refuse to do it. So the Greek guard's like, fine, you step aside, you'll be punished in a minute. So another Jew starts to walk forward to give the sacrifice, and what does Mattathias do? He lunges out, kills the Jew that's going to give the sacrifice, then kills the Greek soldier, and then him and his sons, the Maccabees, run off to the hills with a whole group of revolutionaries. And with the rest of 1 Maccabees, this dialogue is describing these miraculous, incredible victories of war, where this little band of revolutionaries was destroying and decimating tens of thousands of Greek armies. And eventually what happens at the end of 1 Maccabees, John Hyrcanus comes to power, and he establishes what was known as the Hasmonean dynasty. Now this is important, because what has just happened? The nation of Israel has risen up, has destroyed their oppressors, and has established a new dynasty. The Hasmonean dynasty was a major problem for three reasons. One, the king, John Hyrcanus, Hasmonean dynasty, was not from the lineage of David. Huh. Okay, well maybe we can overlook that one. Well, during this time he says, well, you know what, I'm not just king, I'm not just military commander, I'm also the high priest. I'm all of them in one person. Problem is, Hasmonean dynasty was not a part of the lineage of the Zadokites. Problem number two. What did they start doing? The Hasmonean dynasty started spreading their territory by destroying all the villages and everyone that was around them that resisted them. What had they become? Just another Greek empire. just now called the Hasmonean dynasty. During this time, three groups were formed, and this will probably close us out. Three groups were formed because they start realizing, wait a minute, our kingdom hasn't come, because there's a lot of things not right with this kingdom. So three groups formed. The first one was a group by the name of the Pharisees. They form in rebellion. They're saying, wait a minute, this isn't right. Theologically, they were as liberal as can be. They had oral traditions that they were, you know, spouting out, and they would add to the scriptures in a sense. But politically, they were very conservative. They were saying, whoa, we're separating ourselves from the Hasmonean dynasty. You guys are nuts. Because this is not of God. That's one group. Well, responding to the Pharisees is another group known as the Sadducees. They form because they say, wait a minute, theologically, you're way too liberal. As a matter of fact, we're only going to take the first five books of the Old Testament, and that's going to be what we govern by. But what happens to the Sadducees politically? Anybody know? What?
They've been bought out.
Yeah, they sell out. Hasmoneans are like, yeah, we like them better. So they make the Sadducees the ones that are the political power. Another group forms after all this mess starts to come up, and they're known as the Essenes. Where are they located? What? Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is a group of Judaism during this time that says, you know what? You guys are all going to hell in a handbasket. We're going to go be the remnant of Israel. We are going to go establish a community that God will actually appoint as the kingdom to come. So these three groups, warring factions, come and they realize that this dynasty that's been established is not what they thought it was. They thought they had their Davidic warrior king. They thought they had their kingdom, but instead they just had more of the same. 1 Samuel 8. We have time? We have one more minute. We're going to use it. This is what we find at the beginning of the first century. This leads right up into the time of the first century. As a matter of fact, though, in the first century BC, Rome decimates the Hasmonean dynasty. So everything the Maccabees have built up over the next 150 years, destroyed when Rome comes to power. Why? Because these people were wanting to be their own separate nation and Rome wouldn't have it. So Rome displaces them, and Rome does three things. Number one, Rome establishes foreign rulers. A guy by the name of Herod the Great, that'll be important once we get to the first couple of chapters of Matthew. He's an Idumean. He is not Jewish. He is Idumean. They establish him, foreign rulers. The second thing they do is they increase taxation. The Roman tribute, it's estimated by itself, would demand about 40% of what the people made. That doesn't count tithes, that doesn't count other taxes. That's by itself around 40%. And people that are already impoverished, they don't have 40% just to give up. And the third thing that Rome would do is they would use violence to get whatever they wanted. We're going to stop right there. We'll return at that place tomorrow and continue to develop what the kingdom context was that Jesus was speaking. Love you guys. See you in the morning.